Welcome everybody to another episode of the Rule Not the Exception podcast. We, you know, pride ourselves on representing underrepresented communities and have a range of guests on the show, and we've had actors and musicians and photographers, and I'm so glad the guest that we've got in today, because it's another branch off of the tree of guests that we've had, and this time we're delving into something slightly different. So with that being said, I'd like to introduce Sanae Nasethi to the show, who is one third of the sort of power company that is the JKS Restaurants in London. And if you haven't heard of them, you've been living under a rock. And you know, they have some formidable restaurants like Gymkhana and Brigadiers and Hoppers, to name just a few. So yeah, without further ado, Sanae, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
No, you're welcome. So I think I want to start on you three as a trio, and how that came about in terms of starting the restaurants. What were the early years like? And just give the audience an idea about what you guys do and where it came from.
Yeah, sure. So it's myself and my two older brothers. We opened Trishna back in 2008. My middle brother, Karim, is the one who's always been obsessed with food and cooking and restaurants. And I suppose, you know, the three of us, we grew up, our parents were always entertaining. So that sort of hospitality of, you know, at home, feeding people, making people drink, etc., was always, you know, we had that on a weekly basis practically at home. So this whole sort of this thing of hospitality, my parents constantly had, you know, parties for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 people at home. Wow. You know, and my mum did all the cooking. Karen was in the kitchen helping her. Joe, the eldest, was the one that could kind of hold the conversations really with our parents' friends. And I was a sort of little one. And I assumed the role of serving drinks, taking coats and serving drinks. So very much a kind of front of house side of it. And it's really funny how the roles that we assume then is actually the roles that we now assume in the business, or, you know, those are sort of specialist areas. So yeah, we opened Trishna in 2008. Joe was still working for Barclays at the time in private equity. Karim, you know, there full time, and I was actually working for HSBC in Germany. So for Joe and myself, hospitality wasn't ever something that, you know, we considered as careers. But once I moved back to London and started applying for, because I realized in Germany that banking is definitely not for me. So moved back to London, started applying for management consulting roles. And my brothers said, look, you know, our general manager, Trishna's moving back to Austria. My Karim had at that stage taken over as head chef in the kitchen. Will you help us out for a bit? And like 3 days later, my applications went in the bin. I was like, okay, this is it now. So we're gonna do this. And so Karim in the kitchen, myself sort of front of house, and it was intense. It was really intense. But we, you know, at that stage, Trishna was, you know, it was doing okay. It was our first venture in hospitality. I don't think we didn't set the world on fire with it, and we wanted to. So I think at the point where, you know, we were kind of at the helm, it helped because we could really feel and see what we were missing. And yeah, it was at that point within a couple of years of us sort of taking over at the front, we got a Michelin star there. Which was sort of just like a dream come true, really. Never ever imagined that would happen. And, you know, this is back in 2012.
Was that a goal that you guys had in place in terms of, you seem as a trio really aware of branding and sort of what a star could mean? Was that kind of on the cards? Were you aiming for it, or did it kind of just...
It was always something that would be, wow, that would be incredible. But we never really thought that with the style of restaurant that we had, and I suppose our background and everything, that we'd get there. The year before, we got awarded a Bib Gourmand, which is also from the Michelin Guide, which sort of represents, you know, great value food, because we had a couple of really great value tasting menus in place. So, you know, we got that and we were, you know, elated with that and thought, okay, great, this is our recognition from Michelin. And never at all did we expect that a year later we'd actually get the star. So yeah, I mean, of course it's been a goal. I think especially in the earlier days of the Michelin Guide, you know, a lot of chefs would aspire and restaurateurs aspire to, you know, to have that sort of stamp and seal of approval. And we did definitely see overnight business changed. You know, I mean, the influx of people coming through the door, suddenly people are talking about the restaurant, talking about us, whereas before that wasn't really the case.
Can you spot a food critic when they come in?
I'm pretty sure I spotted them when they came in, the Michelin inspectors, when they came in to Trishna. They sometimes do announce themselves, but not always. So they're little things to look out for. But
for some of the listeners that have probably heard of Michelin star, it's quite common in the restaurant game in terms of some of the restaurants that have one. What sort of criteria is there to get one?
So it's tricky to sort of, I suppose, put down the prerequisites, I guess. But and I do, if you look at the restaurants now that have Michelin stars, I think it does definitely vary from country to country. But if you look at the restaurants now that have them, perhaps quite the style of restaurant is very different to you know, what it has been in the past, perhaps. So before, I think there was this connotation of, you know, white tablecloths, quite stiff service, quite, you know, and everything else, when actually they don't often look at the service when looking to award a Michelin star. A lot of it is about consistency of, you know, really high quality food. And, you know, that for that reason, they will come in sort of six times over a period of 12 months, sometimes have two tables, you know, of different, to make sure that you get the same experience no matter where you are in the restaurant. And so, yeah, I think consistency is key. And that's something that we kind of has always been something that we pride ourselves on as well, to make sure that, you know, when you come in one day, you come in 6 months later, you're going to have the same experience.
I actually want to just take it back a little bit. So you guys were working in banking in your respective areas within that. When you decide, okay, we're gonna set up a restaurant and we're gonna go for it that way, what's the conversation like with parents and family, and are they supportive? Are they scared? Are they worried about the risk?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was fortunate enough that my brothers had to do that difficult conversation whilst I was sitting in Germany. and no, look, my parents have been super supportive throughout. They, you know, they backed the whole project, really. And I think they've seen Karim and his talent and his passion for the industry and food. And, you know, he was cooking a lot. He'd set up his own little catering company before that.
He went out to
India for a bit. He trained in some hotel kitchens in India. He worked at Zuma here in London, all in the run-up, because, you know, he's not a professionally or formally trained chef, but actually the way he did it was to get right into the experience and the necessary sort of, you know, skills that were required, I suppose, to open a restaurant. So, you know, I think, you know, they saw his passion and how much he, you know, sort of wanted to put behind it and everything. And they thought, yeah, okay, this is, and the fact that they're such big sort of, I hate the term, but foodies as well, it helps.
I find being a British Asian myself, growing up in Northwest London, there's definitely this second generation mentality where I think the majority of people that I've found or in my circles have gone into banking or in finance. Mm. Some have gone into medicine. And so on and so forth. And I wonder if, were you enjoying your job in banking? Were you enjoying being in the finance sector? Or did you always have something in you to go, I want to try something else?
Exactly. Always had something in me. It was never for me. To be honest, it was, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And it was for the same reason that you just said, it's like an expectation. Okay, so, you know, British Asian, what, you know, lawyer, doctor, banking, lawyer, finance, that kind of accountant sort of thing. And it's kind of like, okay, pick one of those. And something like hospitality was never really presented to, throughout school or, you know, university. It's never really presented to you as an option for a career. So you don't really think about it as that. Whereas actually, my degree at uni was management, business management with German. And actually it fits so well because, you know, with the running of the business and everything else and everything that comes with it, it kind of makes sense. So it's something that you can apply to any industry, really, right? So, I've never would have imagined. And also, you know, when we opened the restaurant, none of us had any experience, okay, apart from Karaman Kitchen, none of us had experience with how do you run a restaurant sort of thing, you know? So you just learn by doing and making mistakes. And, you know, we definitely made quite a few of those. But I think that's the best way of ultimately coming out with a business that, you know, you're proud of at the end of it, because you've gone through the rough times, you've figured out what you did wrong, and then, you know, you come out of it with it's something that you're really proud of.
You said that you when you guys opened Trishnell, you started working there, you kind of wanted to set London or the world on fire with it, but and you didn't quite do that. What does that mean to you guys in terms of setting it on fire? And did you, when you set out to open the restaurant and restaurants now plural, did you have a vision in place, or, you know, did you see a gap in the market? What were you hoping to build with that?
We always wanted to, I mean, you know, we started with one. The plan was, okay, we'd do more than one. It wasn't the intention of, okay, we'll have one standalone sort of thing. We did always want to do more than one. Indian food, of course, making it accessible, but at the same time, not compromising on anything in terms of, you know, what you find in homes. So still keeping it authentic, not westernizing it, not dumbing it down. Just, you know, the level of spicing, the style of food needs to be something that, you know, it feels like it's come from, you know, authentically out of someone's kitchen, or, you know, out of India, et cetera, et cetera. So we wanted to make sure that it wasn't something that was, you know, Indian food sort of Frenchified or you know, westernized in any sort of way, which I think there definitely was a market for as well, you know, whatever, however many, 20 years ago. But for us, it was, you know, we're so proud of our culture and our cuisine and everything else. There's so much to showcase. You know, why would you change that? And also sort of what we've done with, you know, so Trishna being quite focused on the southwest coast of India. And then whereas Gymkhana, a little bit more sort of pan-India, but more heavily sort of on northern India, and Brigadiers as well, very much on the grills, Hoppers, South India and Sri Lanka. So to show just how vast the country is with the cuisine. And it's not just, okay, we're going for an Indian, you know, it's sort of, there's much more to it than that. There's much more choice than that, and it's so regional, and, you know, the sort of meaning behind what you're putting on that plate, because of, you know, where in the country is that coming from, what sort of spices are used there, what style of food is used there. You know, for example, in the south, much more sort of seafood, because of course you're on the coast, whereas, you know, sort of more northern India, a lot of it being landlocked, you know, you can have much more meat, less seafood, etc., etc. So to really showcase that, and almost to use it as a sort of, I won't say education, but to show.
I was about to say, it sounds like you're re-educating the palate
London. In a way that, to sort of differentiate, and to get rid of this whole like curry house generic, you know, generic Indian food, and actually, you know, divide it out and have people understand, you know, the difference.
How much inspiration did you take from, because I can't get over the fact that your mum was cooking for like over 60 people. how much inspiration have you taken from your childhood growing up, and then perhaps with your brother being in India? Where do you, I guess, take that inspiration from, and how do you choose? Because there is so many different kinds of foods and meals and ways of putting them together. Yeah. How do you choose it, and how do you make it really unique to each one of your restaurants?
So this is where Karam's sort of speciality is, really. I think, you know, we grew up going to India at least once, twice a year. Our grandparents were there, and so we spent a lot of time going to India throughout our childhoods, and still do, to be honest. And a lot of it is nostalgia. So things that we remember eating growing up, particularly Karam, because he was always the eater, you know, in our grandparents' houses and kitchens and family homes, etc., in places like, you know, you have... So a lot of socializing happens in places like the golf club and, you know, the Gymkhana club and things like that. So, you know, inspiration of what's a classic meal there and things like that. It's, you know, you kind of bring elements into where they might fit in one of the restaurants as well. A Hoppers being slightly different in the slightly more Sri Lankan focus. So Karam grew up with a lot of sort of second generation Sri Lankan friends at school, and my husband Karan, who the two of them together sort of created this Hoppers brand. He also, when he was here studying in studying law, he had a lot of friends from Sri Lanka as well. So they both, independently, had the idea of, okay, there's no Sri Lankan food really done, particularly in central London. Let's do something. And then so they spent a lot of time sort of researching how they could, you know, how they could create something. Again, making it accessible. You get a lot of very authentic food, Sri Lankan food in, say, Tooting and East Ham, etc. But nothing was really brought to central London made accessible in a way that people would, you know, would be willing to give it a go. So that's kind of, you know, that was the main thing with what we wanted to do on that front, and perhaps the lesser known cuisines as well, is just bringing it, you know, easy access really.
On the point of accessibility, because there is obviously in a metropolitan city like London, the market for really fine dining, like at Gymkhana, is obviously there is, you know, it's very prevalent, and you don't necessarily need to cater to people who perhaps can't afford it. However, that concept of accessibility does transfer into the pricing for you guys as well, because I've, you know, noticed that you can go for the full-on tasting menu, which is in the hundreds, or you can go and sit in at the bar and have bar snacks, and it's 20 quid. Where does that come from, and why is that important to you? I'd love to touch on sort of the family values, and I'm curious about whether that's come from there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I don't think anybody should ever be excluded or think, okay, we won't go to that restaurant because it's too expensive. And, you know, I think, yes, there's certain restaurants that we have which are definitely occasion restaurants. Something like Kitchen Table, for example, which is, you know, it's only 20 seats. We're 20 seats and a, you know, full-on tasting menu, etc. So that is definitely, you know, we consider that as an occasion restaurant. But I think with our Indian restaurants, it's something that you should be able to come and dine exactly like you said. And that's exactly the idea with the way that the menu's designed, is come in and have a beer and a few plates and or beer and biryani or something. Or if you do want to go for the full-on blowout tasting menu wine match, you know, you should be able to do both without there being any difference in your experience. And actually, both of those are experiences in themselves, you know. And so, you know, you could do one of them for lunch one day, and one of them for a dinner in the same week. So, you know, for us, it's really important that, you know, and it was the same with us growing up. You know, I think that's very much the way that when we went out, we didn't go to really fancy places, you know, with our parents. We went to places where we, A, felt looked after, B, of course, food is going to be, you know, the most important, and somewhere we could all agree on. But it was that all-encompassing experience, you know, and I think that's where, for us, it's been so important to make sure that it's, yes, food is always at the number one in everything that we do, but we want to make sure that the drinks that are on top of it, that, you know, the ambience and the experience, the service, the hospitality that you receive, kind of bring everything together for you. And that's kind of what we want, what the thread we'd like to see throughout all of our restaurants.
What are some of the obstacles that you guys have come across from opening the first one to even where you are today? What are some of the things that, the hurdles that you've had to come across that maybe you foresaw or maybe you didn't along the way?
I think, so Trishna being the first one, it was a bit of okay, who are these guys? Do they really know what they're doing?
Who does that come from?
Sorry?
Who does that come from? Who are these guys?
So other people in the industry, perhaps, critics. Mm-hmm. And it's almost a little bit of a sort of suspicious feel to it. And it was actually only really after we opened Gymkhana that people sort of, you know, their interest peaked a little bit, and they were like, okay, now actually, who are these guys and what are they doing? Because that kind of, you know, we couldn't have imagined Gymkhana to take off like it did. And I think, so what one of the obstacles was sort of having that, where you feel like you have to prove yourselves in the industry. And perhaps that's in any industry as well, where perhaps lesser known or whatever else. And you know, will these guys be around long enough and that sort of thing? I do definitely think there's been a lot of change in the industry in the last 10, 12 years, though, for sure, in many, many ways. But that was a sort of, you know, and ultimately with an industry like hospitality, you need the support of your peers to sort of, you know, to really elevate you and to be able to succeed, because it's tough. It's really, really tough. So that was definitely one. Other obstacles along the way, I think the sort of the people side of the business is always going to be really, really tricky. And I think, you know, I mentioned earlier about how not many people see hospitality as a career. Again, definitely changing. But you know, finding people who genuinely want to be doing what they're doing and care about what they're doing, you know, to the same level that you do, was definitely a challenge initially. I think it's, you know, ultimately they're the face of your business, you know, and they're the people who are going to leave the impression on the guests coming in and out of the restaurant. So finding people who, A, would sort of stay for the long term, but B, that you were comfortable with, okay, they they're passionate about it. They're passionate about what they're doing, the food they're serving and everything else. And that ties in with, you know, being able to offer the complete experience to everybody who's dining in any of the restaurants.
Would you say the restaurant game is a meritocracy? Is it a matter of if the food and the service is good, you'll survive, you'll test the, you'll get through it? Or is there a lot more to it than that?
It's tricky. Tricky question. I think, I mean, they're definitely starting points. Definitely starting points. But I mean, on the flip side, I can say they're perhaps restaurants, so the food and the service isn't great and they survive. You need your food to be, to give yourselves the best chance of surviving. You need to make sure that, you know, your food is top and that you care enough about the other bits that go with it to make sure that it will keep people coming back. I think it's, you know, it's one of those, you know, society's so fickle, isn't it? It's, well, you know, what people want. And I think you see it more so elsewhere, I suppose. I think London's still fantastic, but you look at, you know, big cities in India, and, you know, you can go in the same site will have four different restaurants in it over the space of, you know, 18 months, because people go, it's the hit place to start with. And then 3-4 months later, somewhere else opens and that's just dropped. And then you move on, meet more. And that's not for the fact that that place, anything was wrong with it or it changed over those 4 months. It's just purely the fact that somewhere else opened that people kind of shifted their interest to. So I think we're really lucky in London that we're not, it's not to the extent that you'll find in places like India. But yeah, you know, starting point would definitely be make sure that your food and food experience that you offer is, you know, you're proud of it, number one, and B, that, you know, it is what people, it meets expectations, I suppose. But it's really hard because sometimes there's no logic as to why some things work and some things don't.
How often do you guys go about sort of, I guess, meeting and assessing what's working and what's not and keeping yourself, I don't know if current is the right word, but just making sure, I guess, it doesn't go out of fashion to go there, or because it kind of has to be, it's almost like you have to be present and talked about in order for people to come and in some way so saturated, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we've got a great sort of like head office support team that we built, with, like, you know, a sort of marketing department, a design department, et cetera, finance, HR, da da da. So we do, you know, it's constant, really. We're constantly talking about, okay, what do we need to do next? What's coming up? What events are coming up? What can we do? The menus, you know, menus will probably change seasonally every sort of, you know, for every quarter. But it's kind of, you need to be able to react quickly, but then, you know, it should never be knee-jerk. Unfortunately, in the last sort of 6 months, it's been very knee-jerk because it just has to be. But, you know, we do try and plan ahead to, okay, big events, make sure that we're, you know, we're ahead of, okay, what are we doing for Diwali? What are we doing for Christmas? What are we doing for dinner? And keeping the dialogue going through all the channels that we have, you know, our social, our database, everything else. You know, like I said, we are really lucky that we've got a really solid team who constantly coming up with new ideas. You know, what can we do next? What events can we put on? Who can we collaborate with? And I think that's been a really big one in the last couple of years as well, is more of these sort of collaborations with, you know, suppliers, be it drink suppliers, be it, you know, food suppliers, farms, whatever it is. It's I think you need quite a big sort of tank of people to constantly be coming up with ideas. And the three of us are very much, you know, part of that on a daily basis as well, where just brainstorming, discussing, you know, what's next, what can we do next, how do we keep this going, really, and how keep it relevant, like you said.
I remember when I first met you guys, and I've been fortunate enough to have a chat with all three of you. You guys are all so different and bring such different qualities to your company. I imagine. I think the thing that struck me was how young you guys all are. Again, from the outside looking in, the restaurant game as an owner seems like it'd be a higher age bracket. Is that fair to say?
I think it definitely. I mean, I'm young. I don't know my brothers, but I mean, I don't know if they're still classed. But I think, yeah, historically, yes. But again, we've seen so much change. And now you definitely see it as a much younger sort of I guess the demographic of a restaurateur. I don't know what that really means, but yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's less so than before. I think one of the main problems that has been, again, maybe after COVID and everything, this will change, but you know, it's been quite, there are a lot of barriers for young, say, for example, young up-and-coming chefs to be able to just go and open a restaurant themselves, you know. I mean, the costs involved with it, the rents and the competition for trying to secure sites, it was no longer just a case of can you afford the rent on this site to open a restaurant in it. It was the landlord wanting to know, okay, pitch to me. What is it that you're going to put in here? Because, you know, they want to make sure that it's something that they want in, you know, in their site. So, you know, it's crazy. And you think about all the, you know, the huge companies out there, the chains, everything else, with people with a lot more sort of a lot more backing behind them. And so as younger sort of independents, it was much, much more difficult to sort of break through. And that's just sort of starting. That's just acquiring a site. So, you know, again, maybe things will change, and I think we are again seeing things change. So it's very difficult at the moment to know which direction it's going to go in. But you know, I think there's definitely something to be said for a lot of the you know, the sort of the restaurateurs who have been around for a long time, and there's a lot to learn from them, because you know, ultimately they have paved the way for a lot of us.
I know this is a question you've probably been asked so many times over various different interviews. How does that work as a trio with you guys being siblings? Are you able to, when you're at work, keep that business relationship and then switch off when you're at home, and then you may bicker about something as siblings do? How does that dynamic?
That, I mean, it's all blurred, to be honest. It's all completely and utterly blurred together. But I think that's our biggest strength and I don't know about biggest weakness, but yeah, it's definitely our biggest strength. The fact that, you know, when we're at work, you can sit around the table, you can shout about stuff if you need to, you can swear at each other if you need to, but ultimately, you know, you've all got the same end goal, and you'll figure it out and get to that end goal quicker maybe than if you're in a little bit more of a formal environment where you have to tiptoe around a little bit, be careful about what you say. So, you know, of course, there are going to be disputes and arguments and things like that, but there are no politics, which is great, between the three of us at least. There are no politics, which is, and you know, over the years, it's been, you know, it's been 12 years now since we opened Trishna, and we've definitely found our rhythm and found our areas, which means there's much less sort of treading on toes as well between the three of us, which in the earlier days, that can sometimes happen and that can cause a little tension. But, you know, now we're very much defined in what we do and what we're responsible for. You know, we have inherent trust in each other that, okay, you know, obviously we know that Karim is all things design and creative and food. So that's his baby. You know, for me, on the sort of operation side and the beverage side and the people side, that's my baby, and I'm left to carry on with that. And Joe just makes sure we don't kill each other, sort of thing. We've definitely grown into it, and you know, you do come across challenges, but then you figure out how to overcome it. And like I said, I think the fact that we're siblings, and you know the way each other operate, you know the way that each other work, and you know, and how to get what you need out of each other as well, I suppose, which is always a good thing.
I'd love to chat about the beverage side of things, because it's quite a big part of your position in life, I guess. Yeah. And you're done with your sommelier now.
Yeah, so I finished my diploma, my WSET diploma, 2017. Mm-hmm. And one of my main reasons for doing that was so that I could set us up as JKS, as like as a school, a wine school. So I did that in 2017, but then got pregnant, so I had to wait. And it was last year that I set us up as a approved kind of program provider for the WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust, and which has been amazing, because it means that I can teach our employees, and you know a sort of wine level two, sort of an intermediate and an advanced level, and I can do, you know, I've been doing sort of classes at 12, all of them from different backgrounds in terms of the different restaurants. So bringing them together, which is great, getting them to interact with each other. Different sort of offerings in the restaurants as well, but then sort of bespoke it a little bit more to, you know, to what we do, as opposed to it being a really generic program. You know, we can actually discuss and round it to the JKS way, I suppose. And that's been great. And it's been, for me, it's been amazing because I actually get to spend like 4 or 5 weeks with these guys sort of in a much more intimate, rather than going and being like, hi, not knowing their names and that sort of thing. You know what I mean? So it's been really, really amazing. Obviously, we put a hold on it over COVID, but I'm planning to start up again very soon. So we've already put about 50 people through it, and we plan to sort of get around as many as possible because, you know, they're amazing skills to have, to give people the confidence, you know, particularly, you know, on the floor, chatting to guests about things. And just, you know, I think it's also something that a lot of people are really keen to learn about, whether they see hospitality as a career or not. I think it's just a nice kind of life skill to have, is just have a basic foundation and understanding of wine.
Where did your interest in wine and becoming a sommelier come from?
So my dad's always been, you know, keen on wine. He's never been sort of keen on learning about it, but he knows what he likes to drink, sort of thing. And when I took over at Trishna, for those of you who've been, it's sort of like a U-shaped, and the bar oversees the busier side of the restaurant. And we needed a bartender at the time. And I thought, okay, look, I've never worked in a restaurant before. I'd worked my uni bars and stuff like that before, but I decided to take over the bar so that I could sort of oversee what's going on in the restaurant and, you know, understand it while still feeling like I was slightly protected by standing behind this bar. And it was always, you know, I loved giving people drinks, kind of thing. And so it was there that I started, you know, experimenting a little bit more whilst trying to understand the full operation of the restaurant. We had a sommelier at the time who was great, really passionate about, you know, wine and generally tasting a lot of things, really excited about what we could do and create at Trishna. But I found myself picking up a lot of the, you know, the boring stuff, like the cellar management, the wine list printing, the stock takes, etc. And I was like, hang on a minute, what's going on here? Why am I doing all the boring stuff and this guy's doing all the fun stuff, the tasting and the meeting producers and winemakers and whatever? So so that's when I thought, okay, I had a basic understanding of wine, but I thought, let me go and get like my qualifications, my WSET. So I finished my advanced level sort of quite quickly, within a few months of sort of taking that decision, and then took over the wine list completely. And, you know, doing loads of really cool stuff with matching food and wine and Indian food and wine, because in those days we were still very much, you know, 8 out of 10 tables were coming in and saying, we're having a curry, we need a beer, sort of thing, you know. And now that's completely flipped, which is great.
And you look at quite unusual regions for wine as well, like Greece and even India, which I found fascinating. What excites you about it? And how do you find, I guess, how do you source and find the places that you get your stock from?
We work with some really great distributors. So in the earlier days, actually, it was, especially as a standalone restaurant, it's very difficult to get wines through outside of using, you know, the distributors within London, but they're hundreds and hundreds of them. So it's really kind of honing in on people with a portfolio that you find suitable for you. So, I mean, the days of just Trishna, I'd work with like 30, 35 different distributors and sort of keep asking for new things. It's, you know, a lot of the sort of Croatian, Greek, Slovenian wines hadn't really made waves in the UK market because of, I suppose, people's perceptions of them and things like that. But, you know, we were really fortunate with the tools that we had by doing things like tasting menus with pairings and, you know, recommending a different glass of wine with each dish on our menu and stuff like that. That, you know, it gives you the tools where people, you know, if you just put a Greek wine or in those days at least, a Slovenian wine by the bottle on a list, people are like, do I want to fork out 40 quid for something? I have no idea how it's going to be. Whereas you give them the option of going for a tasting menu where you can take them on this journey and sort of choose the wines for them, they're more likely to, you know, to sort of be like, okay, I'll have a little bit. If I don't like it, I'll change it, sort of thing. So working with great distributors who sort of help with sourcing, and if you say, look, you know, I'm really looking for something like this, they'll go out and sort of help bring it into the UK. Then subsequently, a lot more traveling around, looking for things that are unique, looking for things that work with our cuisine, because that's ultimately the first and foremost. You need things that are going to work with the food, because otherwise that can actually just kill the entire meal.
I'm curious to know, your relationship with your parents now, in terms of, is there a pressure when they come into the restaurant? Do you feel like you have to make sure that they're proud, they're making sure that everything's on point for them? How is that? Because again, you talk about the early days when they were the hosts, and now they'll come into the restaurant and essentially you're hosting them. Do you feel a sense of pressure around that?
It definitely did in the early days. Now it's, we know we're going to be getting some sort of feedback at the end of it. So it's like, it's just waiting. It's like, so what happened now, sort of thing. And it was more so, I definitely felt it when they would come in, and they would often come in with their friends, and I was serving them. That I really felt it then, at Trishna particularly. And, you know, my dad isn't necessarily the easiest guest, and so we have to turn him off quite often.
On the night, or do you wait till...
Sometimes on the night if he's really misbehaving, but, you know, it's... Yeah, my mum's very easy and sort of just lets us get on with it. But he's... I often when they are entertaining, for them, it's them wanting to showcase kind of what we've achieved to their friends, you know? So... From both sides, it's really important that we get it right.
And likewise, when you have like family events at someone's house, and you talked about your mum being the one who cooked for a vast amount of people in the early days, has that changed? Does your brother now go into the kitchen? Who gets pushed into doing the cooking?
Yeah, it's definitely changed, because I think she had enough of sort of, you know, 40 years of having to entertain and, you know, and cooking for, and the fact that, you know, as soon as we all left home, she's like, well, I'm just cooking for me and your dad now. And sort of, you know, she kind of loses the, you lose the inspiration a little bit. Nowadays, when we get together, there, if it's at my parents' house, there's definitely a case of too many chefs, because Kyron, my husband, cooks a lot as well. So that there's lots of input going on. So we do, you know, that it always ends up being an incredible meal. But, you know, with lots and lots of different sort of directions to it. So, you know, when we go on holidays together as well, it's great, because Kyron and Kyron end up sort of just creating something. None of us know what's going on. And then suddenly, you know, a few hours later, you've got this amazing spread. We're really lucky in that. My dad still, whenever there's going to be a bigger bunch, he's like, let's just get takeaway, get some food from one of the restaurants or something, because he doesn't want there to be all the, you know, effort and like someone's going to end up slaving in the kitchen, the washing up, the this, the that. So he's kind of like, let's actually enjoy spending some time together. Yeah. Whereas that's a no-go for the majority of us.
And you grew up in northwest London, in Finchley, right?
Finchley, yeah.
How was that growing up? Because again, for someone who, you know, I also grew up in a similar area, you know, and there's a huge South Asian community. Did you find you took inspiration from some of those restaurants? Because there were, over the years, so many Asian restaurants that will come and go. Did you find yourself pulling inspiration from any of those, or do you feel like what you guys have done is very much standalone in itself?
I think we definitely went to a lot of, you know, your Lahore kebab houses, your Malibu's, Regency's, etc. We definitely went to them quite regularly, and they're institutions and them in their own rights. And, you know, we still really enjoy going to those restaurants. I think in different ways, perhaps on the food side, inspiration can be drawn. But then what we've done is, so for example, if you look at, I don't know, Gymkhana, so somewhere like a lot of these places, the Lahore kebab house, whatever, their Sikh kebabs are sort of what they're, you know, the grills are what they're known for. But then what we'd do is, you know, we'd use something like quail at Gymkhana, or Wagyu beef at Brigadier's or something like that. So sort of put our spin on it in terms of keeping the authenticity of it, but you know, utilizing either something seasonal or something that can sort of take it away from again the curry house kind of feel, really.
One of the themes that have come up in the podcast this season is education, And I know you guys were privately educated coming up.
My brothers were.
Okay, the brothers.
Yeah.
Do you know how? Well, I guess that's a perfect example then. Do you feel like there's a difference in terms of approach, in terms of depth of knowledge that they're able to bring to the table, and maybe something different that you're able to based on that educational background?
I'm so glad you asked that question. it's usually something I have to sort of worm into conversation. There's definitely completely different. I mean, my brothers went to Haberdashers, which is... I need to try to sound as diplomatic as possible when I'm saying all of this. So Haberdashers, which is, you know, a lot of Asians, a lot of, say, Jewish people, a lot of, you know, it's not a very diverse background, let's say. I think inevitably with any sort of private school, you know, you can imagine that the demographic is going to be quite similar in terms of, you know, the families, et cetera, et cetera. And absolutely nothing, I'm not saying anything against that at all, but, you know, it's a debate that we're all having at the moment when thinking about where to send our children to school. And of course, from our point of view, it's yes, okay, private education, do we want to? But then my view, my immediate response is, but, you know, what I loved so much about my education is just growing up with people from so many different backgrounds, from so many different cultures. And that really, I think that really makes a difference to, you know, how you view things and your approach to things as well. So it's a big kind of, you know, dilemma and question. I think there are definitely times with the business, which is why I'm glad that I'm on the sort of people side of the business and, you know, the HR/people side of the business as well, because perhaps my approach is different to particularly Joe's banker approach often, which is, but it's really important that you have both to, you know, to keep a balance, because it's, you know, you have the numbers game and then you also have the, you know, these are our employees that we want to look after, and we really need to make sure that they feel proud to work for us as a company. So I think it's good to have balancing factors on both sides. And I think a lot of that does definitely come from our educations, in terms of, you know, what we're exposed to at the different stages of our education. So I don't know. I think, again, I feel like I'm a little bit out of touch as to how things are at the moment in terms of, you know, private schools and state schools sort of things, and what generally is the sort of the sentiment. But I think, you know, different opportunities given to both of us, well, to all three of us, I suppose. I think, you know, that in terms of the opportunities they were perhaps given on the sporting side, et cetera, would have been much, much better than the opportunities I perhaps had, but that was fine by me. Perhaps on the musical side, I had more opportunity, and that's fine by them. So it kind of, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's interesting to see it, but I do definitely think on a day to day, you know, that there are sort of telling points.
Was your choice, and I assume it was your choice to go state school, well, was that challenged or?
No, I think the main thing is that I didn't want to go to a single state school. That was my main, and I think that also ties into it. I just did not want to go to a single state school. I remember I went for the open day or exam or whatever at Haberdashers Girls, so the girls' equivalent of the school my brothers were at. I just said to her, I just don't want to come in, because I'd been to my primary school was a co-ed school, and, you know, I couldn't imagine going to a school with only girls. I wanted there to be that mix of, you know, and that variety. Yeah, it was, and perhaps also growing up with two older brothers, being quite a tomboy, that just really scared me, you know. So that was one of the main reasons for it. And, you know, the school I went to in Potter's Bar was fantastic. It was, you know, it was a really great state school. And, you know, I was really fortunate that I had the opportunities I had there.
Did it come with the pressure of making sure you had to do well? Like, if you dropped a grade, it'd be like, well, we told you so. Maybe not on the surface, but...
Yeah, it was a little bit, but I still beat them both to be GCSEs. So, I mean, that's all that matters, right? a little bit. I did feel that, you know. But also, I think already in at that age, I was feeling like, you know, I need to prove to my parents that it's not all about this private education stuff. You know, it's not all about that. It's, you know, there are other options. There are other, you know, you don't need to spend all this money. You don't need to whatever. So I think that was part of it. That was a driving force as well.
How are you feeling now about the choices about sending your kid to private school or not? I mean, you might be homeschooling.
Yeah,
that's true.
I know. Still a debate in my head, to be honest. I think it's just, I think so much of it is based on the personality of the child as well. And I think, you know, my brother's thrived at school and at their school, but I think if I was put in a similar situation, I wouldn't have. So I think, and a lot of it is based on personality, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, my son's only 2.5, so I still think there's some time to sort of to figure it out and see what would be best for him.
I think it'd be silly to ignore, you know, the climate that we're in at the moment. So I'd love to speak about how the climate's been for the restaurant business in terms of COVID-19 and just 2020 in general, how that's affected things. And are you approaching things differently? Is there, you know, have you guys managed to look at things a bit differently?
Yeah, absolutely. So 2020 started great. we reopened Gymkhana, as you guys know, after being shut for 8 months because of the fire last year. And we opened a new hopper site in King's Cross. And literally within sort of, you know, four weeks of Gymkhana opening, 6 weeks of hoppers opening, we had to shut everything down. So it was obviously just a huge blow, and you know, to all of us, you know, for me and my brothers, just think, whoa, okay, this, like, just overnight everything gone to zero. And you know, at that stage we had 750 employees to sort of think about and look after, whilst trying to figure out, you know, what's going on with the business and everything. And so, like I said, overnight from to sort of zero, we do have a takeaway brand called Motu. But you know, I think in that real uncertainty in back in March, you know, a lot of the chefs were also very anxious to travel to work and things like that. So we took the call that, you know, if the rest of the business is shut, we're also going to shut that. And we didn't reopen that until sort of May, beginning of May. And it definitely did sort of ring alarm bells with us, saying, you know, this is happening. We don't know how long this is happening for, but essentially we've lost 90% of our business. So, you know, the sort of cog started moving into, okay, what else do we need to, can we be doing, and shifting our focus and everything else to make ourselves a more robust business, really. So, you know, the delivery aspect for all of the restaurants or majority of the restaurants started. The sort of, so what we've just launched this week is the retail aspect, so the sort of at-home kits, make, you know, get pre-marinated meats, meal kits, booze to sort of complement, and non-alcoholic to complement, and, you know, order it, cook it at home. You have a great full-on experience at home for, you know, four people, and it's kind of like, you know, you've had there's a bit of activity to it as well, rather than it just being a takeaway that's come kind of lukewarm. You know, things like that we've moved towards. You know, obviously a lot more online stuff, generally speaking, which, you know, for everyone, I think that's just been accelerated over the last however many months, you know, 8 months. So it's, it definitely did get, was it, of course, a wake-up call as for us, as it was for a lot of people, to, you know, start thinking about a different way of doing things and making ourselves more robust. In terms of, you know, the plans that we had at the beginning of the year, we had a lot of sort of potential sites. We were including Gymkhana and Hoppers King's Cross, we were planning to open sort of 6 or 7 restaurants this year, which of course not happening. So, you know, we still are not putting the brakes on our growth, but we're perhaps taking it in a slightly different way. And different opportunities are arising now, you know, that perhaps weren't before, or perhaps that we wouldn't have considered before. So it's sort of viewing things in a different way. It's viewing things with arguably more of an open mind, and looking at, you know, looking at sort of future proofing, I guess.
And how were, and yourself and obviously your brothers, how are you guys with spending time at home? during that time? Are you someone who likes to keep busy, or were you driving yourself crazy, or were you sort of okay?
I think the three of us reacted quite differently. It's been difficult with kids at home. Amazing to spend so much time with them, but then, you know, trying to get things done, and then just feeling like you're not giving enough attention to either side, you know, not enough attention to the kids or not enough attention to work. And so that was tricky. But once sort of, you know, nurseries and things like that reopened, I'm continuing to work from home a couple of days a week. The rest of the time in the office, because a lot of what we do, instead of having face-to-face meetings, of course, has moved to online. And to be honest, if I've got a day where I'm on calls, there's no point in me sitting in the office and doing it, because then you're going to have to find a quiet place and this and that. So I end up doing that from home. I definitely, over the 6 months that we were, or whatever, 5 months that we were out of, you know, at home constantly, you do feel like you need a change of, you know, just to get out and go pick up a sandwich sort of thing, you know. I felt that when I was maternity leave as well, just being able to like get up and go and pick up a sandwich is such a small joy that you know, if it's taken away from you, you miss it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think one of the other great things about the restaurant business I found is the types of guests that you guys have. And I guess famously, you've got some huge famous guests that come in and out of the restaurants, people like Ed Sheeran, David Beckham. Does that really help take the restaurants to a level in terms of the press that it brings? And do you notice a difference in the people that come through the doors with that?
Sometimes. I think it can definitely be a positive and a negative. I think, you know, the positive is that, you know what, like, Ed Sheeran comes to Gymkhana and David Beckham, both of them come quite regularly, and they genuinely really enjoy it. And so to have that, like, and, you know, particularly someone like David Beckham, my brother's huge, huge football fans, you know, to have that, it's like, yes, you know, it's as good as getting a Michelin star sort of thing, you know.
I think that's all we spoke about. We spoke about Man United for like an hour. Yeah,
exactly.
That night.
Not surprised. But on the negative, you'll get like people's responses. I think we got a review once after David Beckham had been into the restaurant, saying, you know, obviously they, you know, our experience was okay, but David Beckham said that his was fantastic. So obviously they, you know, they have preferential treatment for different people, you know. So I think expectations then change, and so people will then say like, well, you know, well, we obviously didn't get as much of a we didn't get the VIP treatment like David Beckham must have, which is all speculation and all whatever. But so, you know, it comes with it, I suppose, when celebrities will throw you into the spotlight and things like that, that the level of expectation comes with it. And that's, you know, it's not only celebrities, it's things like the Michelin star that do that. It's things like, you know, any sort of accolades or recognition do ultimately raise expectations a lot. And those are quite...
It sounds like you guys love rising to the challenge a bit, though.
Yeah, it's great.
Speaking to you three, it sounds like it just keeps driving you in the right direction, really.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, for us, it's we love what we do, and it's just, we just want to make sure that, you know, people feel that full package of, you know, whenever they're coming in our restaurants.
We've had actors on the show who have won awards, and, you know, that comes with great... praise and recognition. I wonder if getting a Michelin star comes with the pressure of going, do we need to get one every time now? Or do you feel a sense of failure if you don't?
Well, to be honest, the discussion is often, if you get a Michelin star and then lose it, it's probably worse than having the star in the first place. Yeah. It's probably worse than having it in the first place.
That probably is.
To be honest, I mean, controversial or not, but I don't think they carry as much weight as they perhaps did in the past. I mean, you still wouldn't say no to one, right? But I mean, it's, because, you know, if you were to receive it, and you have to retain it every year. And if you don't, and, you know, of course, if a restaurant shuts down, or sometimes if, you know, someone leaves, or if it's the restaurant is dependent upon a chef, for example, and that chef leaves, then, you know, they might lose a star. And sometimes that's worse than actually even having it from day one. So it's tricky, you know. I think it's one of those that some people, you know, pay heed to it, some people just, you know, not interested sort of thing. So
it's, why do you feel it's not as important as maybe it once was?
I think there are a lot, you know, with how sort of social media has taken off and how there's so many different sources to get sort of reviews, information, you know, just on where to eat, where's good to eat, where's, you know, and for a lot of people, it's okay, they want to see what they want to eat rather than just knowing if it's got a star. So actually, okay, such and such place has been recommended to me. Let me go on Instagram and see what the food looks like, sort of thing. And, you know, or who else is talking about it? I think, you know, a lot of bloggers, a lot of influencers, people start to, you know, find who they like with similar tastes and things like that. And so they're likely to follow what they would say, regardless of, you know, has it got a Michelin star or not. And I think things are evolving a lot. And where that was almost, you know, yes, of course, critics and reviews and things, but where the Michelin guide was very much, you know, the stamp of approval. There are now so many other things out there when it comes to, you know, people deciding, you know, where they want to eat, etc.
Do you feel like in the last 5 or 10 years that shift has very much become clear in terms of marketing more on social media has become maybe more influential than broadsheets?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I think, you look at the sort of what happens with press and things, and I think, yeah, in print is... I'm not saying it's completely gone, but it's, you know, it's there, but it perhaps carries less weight than it used to. And things on, you know, on social media are definitely sort of there.
Because someone, you know, I follow David Beckham and I noticed that he does tag you guys and take photos. And I imagine that brings in, you know, a nice amount of followers and probably people come through the doors, and it makes such a difference to maybe a critic as in the past.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. I think... you know, then it depends who you're right. It's a completely different crowd. So perhaps those are people who aren't going to be the ones who care about Michelin stars or care about what the critics have said, but they'll go because David Beckham won. So I think that's also why when you've got tools like social media and people who are seeing this going on, they're more likely to go to restaurants based on that and who they trust or who they believe in to tell them a good restaurant.
Which restaurants you go to? I mean, aside from your own, do you have any favourites in London?
Do you even eat at your own? Because it feels like work, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, less and less. Curran is regularly at them tasting because it's important to make sure that, you know, that the levels of consistency and quality are there. We do it then. But when it comes to choosing others, I think a lot of it is, of course, you know, what's new. You know, we have our sort of favourites, Northwest London style restaurants, which we still like to go to as well. But yeah, it's just kind of experimenting, seeing what other people are doing. And then, you know, I think for me, like Thai food, one of my favourites, are just going, trying what else, you know, where can we get really great Thai food? So it's not, to be honest, that's probably one of the hardest, what causes the most fights whenever we're going, like where we're going for dinner. You like, just never be able to decide anywhere. So it's, but it's nice to sort of, support, you know, the rest of the industry, but also, you know, just sort of see what other people are doing too.
Are you able to switch off when you go into somebody else's restaurant and go for a nice meal, or are you looking at service and standards and foods? And I guess to an extent we all do, but you know, when you're in the industry, on a professional level, are you able to switch off?
Yes and no. I feel like I'm better than my husband Curran, because I get irritated with him. I'm like, just enjoy it now, right? Like, particularly if they're things that are maybe red flags initially, and then he'll go on about that, and I'm like, well, you just killed the dinner now, haven't you? So it's you know, after a point, yes, you'll look out for things, but to try and not let it completely overrun your meal is important, because otherwise it takes away that joy of eating out, really, you know. But yeah, 100%, it is very difficult to not keep, you know, looking at this, what glassware are they using, how they serve, you know, how what's the service like, what's everything like. But yeah, for me, I still definitely don't want to lose that, you know, that joy of going in and eating out in a restaurant and just, yeah.
One of our key themes as part of the podcast as well is representation and inclusivity. So I'd love to know your opinion in the restaurant industry in terms of representation and inclusivity. Is there a lot of people from South Asian backgrounds that own restaurants? Do you find it's quite a multicultural industry, or maybe less so?
I do, actually. I do find it quite multicultural. I think it's an industry where, you know, you can imagine, because of the breadth of cuisines that we've got across the board, that, you know, you are going to find representatives, you know, across the world, really, which is great. So it's perhaps an easier industry to have more of that inclusion, you know. So, it's in terms of the sort of the restaurateur side of it, the sort of the chef, owner, that sort of side of it, you definitely see a good sort of breadth across the board. To be honest, I've never felt of it as being, sort of dominated by, you know, but by whatever. So, generally speaking, I think we're pretty lucky.
Yeah.
And in terms of being sort of female in the industry as well, and being a mother now, how have you juggled that, and have you found it okay being sort of at the head of a trio and being the only female? Does that come with pros and cons?
Yeah, it does. I think, you know, it's particularly in the early days, especially when we were sitting in meetings, I was definitely treated like the little sister. But I think that's also natural, because that's always been the dynamic between the three of us, you know. And I think that kind of gave me more of a fire to be like, right, got to prove myself, sort of thing. It was that case in, not with my brothers, because that you overcome that really quickly, I think. But on the wine side, and, you know, back sort of 10 years ago, it was much more male dominated. And I remember going into a tasting where I'd been doing lunch service at Trishna, and I've got on the tube to go over to, I think it was like the Andaz Hotel or something like that in Liverpool Street, and there was a Bordeaux tasting. And I walked into this room, and I was just wearing, like, you know, a sweater and black trousers or whatever. Walked into this room with probably about 25 men, all suited, and I think the youngest was like 55 or something like that, and I was 23 at the time. And the looks I got when I walked into that door was like, are you sure you should be here, sort of thing. And it was immediately, you just feel so uncomfortable. But again, that was another thing that was like, right, just, it sort of just encourages you to push on and to prove, you know, like, well, you just need to have the confidence to overcome it. And that did happen often when, you know, people in Trishna would ask for the sommelier, and I would kind of come along, and they'd look you up and down and be like, sure you know what you're talking about, sort of thing.
Do you think having two older brothers who, you know, obviously come across as really confident as well, do you think that's helped you? Like, have they pushed you to, not pushed necessarily, but I guess molded you or helped you be fiery and self-sufficient?
Yeah, I think because maybe it's not only the fact that they're two older brothers, but it's the fact, I think, when you're one of three, I think you constantly have to sort of fight to be heard a little bit. I definitely do think so. I think it's given me the confidence. I always, as you know, growing up, I think I had the confidence to talk to older people. You know, Joe's 8 years older than me, so, like, even, you know, when I was eight, talking to 16-year-old friends and things, and I would love to just have a conversation with them. And so I think that then gave me the confidence and the ability to sort of feel confident and comfortable enough around others when talking about things. So, you know, when someone's asking me about wine in the restaurant, and I'm, whatever, I was a 23-year-old, and these guys have obviously, you know, spent a lot of time either, you know, drinking wine, reading about wine, understanding wine, visiting wineries, etc., far more than I ever had. So I have to kind of forget about that and be like, right, you put this wine list together, you still know it better than they do, so just, you know, give them what they want to drink, sort of thing.
We have run out of time.
But I would love to ask a final question.
Go on.
Spin on what we usually ask the creative lot. When you're, and this is quite a creative question actually, when you are putting together the wine list with the food menus and everything, what's the best part? Is it sort of sourcing everything and getting it all together? Is it the process of that, or is it watching people come in and enjoy it and being part of that service and that pouring that you talked about? Like, what part of, I guess, the whole from conception to people coming to the restaurant, what part of it do you enjoy the most and get the most kick out of if you had to choose?
I think it's that point at which, so I mean, the beginning, what scares me the most, because I'm not that creative as a person. My brother definitely is. Karan, my husband definitely are. They're both very creative. I'm not. So that point of where you've got a blank canvas quite scares me. I get a bit flustered and I'm like, okay, where to start sort of thing. Whereas for them, that's great. You know, you can create anything you want. But for me, it's once you kind of get your head around that, you kind of sift through whatever you need to, you have a final product that you're proud of, and then it's the delivery of it, and then seeing people, you know, be it opening a restaurant, so you know, that first day that you have people through the door, I still like, you know, the paying customers, you're like, wow, these people actually want to come and eat in this restaurant, this thing that we created from scratch, you know, sort of thing, and that's an amazing feeling.
Amazing. So people can find all the information on their restaurants on jksrestaurants.com. Guys, check out their food. It's amazing. I can definitely attest to that.
I'm definitely going to get the at-home kits. I think they're brilliant.
Cool. Do it.
Amazing. Sunaina, thank you for being on the Rule Not the Exception podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.